Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Puttock, one of your hosts for today, together with my co-host, Susan Franzen. Hello, Susan. And hello, listeners. Susan, I'm especially glad to have you as my co-host, because you're a historian, which I'm not. And that will be especially appropriate for an important segment of our show today. And hello again, listeners. We've got an ambitious show lined up today. We'll be hearing from local experts and neighbors on the topics of human dignity, the role of government, and the destiny of democracy.
Yes, those are pretty fun topics to talk about. Today is President's Day on top of all that. And this month, February, is African American History Month. And so one of the guests we'll be delighted to be welcoming today is a history professor from Iowa State who has the special expertise on American presidents of the Civil Rights era. And we'll be hearing from Professor Brian Behnken later today. So stay tuned for that. But before we delve into these more serious topics, Kay, I believe you've got something in a lighter vein. A brief clip for us that's appropriate for the day after Valentine's Day?
Yes, just for fun, in honor of Valentine's, I asked three women friends to tell me how they met their husbands. We'll hear the responses from two friends right now, and maybe there'll be time for a third at the end of the program. You'll notice that all three, like me, are Americans of British origin. And there's some background noise because we were at the stomping grounds at the time I made this recording.
I met David in 1976 at a dance at Birmingham University. So a group of girls from Shenstone New College, Teacher Training College, went to Birmingham for the dance on a Friday night. And it was pretty disastrous. It was terrible. And I was accosted by a student who wanted to keep buying me a drink. And I was saying, no, no, I don't want to drink. And I looked over, and the tall guy was lying against a column, a pillar. And he came up to me and said, if you don't want to drink, would you like to dance? And I said, yes. So that's how I met David.
Chris next.
It's very similar. We met as undergraduates. I think I'd been at university 2 weeks, and it was at a disco. And mine isn't so romantic. He was with his tall friend, very tall friend, and the girl I was with was taller than me, so he danced with me because he took the shorts.
Listening to those British accents reminds me that we also celebrate Black History Month in Britain, but in Britain it's celebrated in October instead of February. But the next guest brings up good questions for President's Day. How should we think about the role of government? How should the government act in order to promote the public interest? This next guest has an interesting perspective on these questions. She's Ames resident Carolyn Raffensperger, who works for the Science and Environmental Health Network, and she's been carefully following the debate about the proposed Bakken pipeline, the crude oil pipeline, which cuts diagonally across the state of Iowa from the Dakotas. Last week, the three-person Iowa Utilities Board held public deliberations about the pipeline, and Carolyn has been following that debate very closely. She spoke with Local Talk reporter Greta Anderson last week after the Utilities Board declined to make an immediate decision on the pipeline. The interview starts off with Carolyn Raffensperger describing the members of the anti-pipeline coalition.
I work for the Science and Environmental Health Network, and we're the fiscal sponsor for the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition. So we've been helping to shepherd, you know, some of the logistics through and helping the coalition overall.
And that coalition is made up of a whole number of groups. Can you just give us a sampling of them?
Oh, it's wonderful. We have 100 Grannies. We have Interfaith Power and Light, Iowa Interfaith Power and Light. We have the Sierra Club, many, many organizations. And what's interesting about the coalition itself is that it's probably been the most successful environmental coalition in a very long time in Iowa. And I think that's unique about it is having both environmentalists and landowners who don't traditionally get along or agree. But on this, we're united. And that's been quite a remarkable experience.
And this past week, the Iowa Utilities Board held 4 days of deliberation that were open to the public. Prior to that, mostly in December, there was a whole long series of hearings. Can you describe what was the difference between those two?
Well, it's a long and convoluted process, and so the Iowa Utility Board has the major responsibility for granting a permit to Dakota Access for the Bakken Pipeline. And they had a requirement for interveners to submit briefs. Then they had a public comment day where they took pretty much equal comments from supporters and opponents. And then they held a quasi-judicial proceeding, which looked like a courtroom. And so the three utility board members sat up on a high stage, and lawyers presented witnesses based on their written. The Science and Environmental Health Network intervened in these proceedings as a party to the proceedings on behalf of future generations. That has never happened before, as far as I know, in an administrative proceeding in this country. And so we often think, well, you're voting your own interests, your self-interests. But I think that Iowans, I saw years ago the sign coming into the airport before the 2008 elections, and it said, "We vote for children." And at that proceeding, we had intervened on behalf of future generations. So I did a statement that was a question and answer statement that represented the interests of the great-grandchildren of you or your neighbor's great-grandchildren. It was a really remarkable experience. But it was highly technical. It really required a familiarity with the legal procedures. And even lawyers who participated in it were a bit daunted. Now, what the Iowa Utility Board just did was held their deliberations where they talked to each other about what they think about the evidence. And it was incredibly disappointing. Now, it's not over yet. So the next steps are they will continue to deliberate in public. For the most part, they can go into closed session for a variety of reasons. But they will hold additional deliberations on Friday, February 19th. And it's been a process that should be eye-opening to Iowans. For one thing, this is a massive project. It is the largest proposed pipeline project in the country. It is slated to carry 570,000 barrels of crude oil a day through the lands and the waters of Iowa. So how should we make a decision like that? What should the voice of the public be in this kind of thing? So the Iowa Utility Board, three members who are not elected, they're appointed by the governor. Two are Republicans following the party affiliation of the governor, and one is a Democrat by law. And they have admitted that there is no legal precedent for citing what they call a hazardous liquids pipeline. We have 44,000 miles of existing pipelines, and 12 miles of those are hazardous liquid pipelines. And that one's defunct. It's not in operation anymore. And so something that is planned for the entire state of Iowa that has vast implications for the future in terms of climate, water quality, soil quality, how should we make a decision like that? They have no legal precedent. The process has essentially cut out the public. It's been evident throughout this that there isn't really good mechanisms for the public to participate. The Department of Natural Resources held a hearing that was a debacle. The Des Moines Register wrote an editorial against it. This is not democracy. This is not an appropriate way to get the voice of the public and its input into the sovereign lands and waters of Iowa, the commonwealth that we all share. And so I think that we've seen that the law is not up to the challenge. The process has been inadequate. The Iowa Utility Board doesn't even know which other permits needs to come first or second. Do they have the authority to grant the permits and then wait for the federal agencies and the other state agencies that have to have permits? So the Army Corps of Engineers has to have permits around the waters of the United States. This crosses the Missouri River, crosses the Mississippi River. It has implications for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So we have federal agencies, we have state agencies like the Department of Natural Resources and the Iowa Utility Board, and then county boards have to make decisions about the drainage districts and the roads that this pipeline will cross. So the process has not been clear and also not up to the challenge. And then finally, the utility board members themselves are not well versed in the risks that are posed by this. And the evidence that they limited by design, limited the kind of information on which they could make a decision. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a failed process. They've limited public comment, and they've made sure that even in the public comment period, that proponents and opponents were one for one. There were far more opponents from in-state. So the people who opposed the pipeline were almost all Iowans, and the people who were for the pipeline were almost all out-of-staters. But they made it look like it was equal. And then in the hearing itself, ordinarily, a lawyer would be able to cross-examine the witnesses of other parties. And then you get out a much richer body of information. And so yesterday, the chair of the Iowa Utility Board, Jerry Huser, said that maybe she hadn't asked the right questions. You know, now they had to make a decision based on evidence, and they didn't even have what they needed. But now they don't have adequate information for making the decision because they limited it themselves. And then there's no information for the board. There's no direction on how they should weigh long-term damage and threats of damage like climate change or threats to water or threats to private land or the fact that the eminent domain payment is a one-time payment, but the pipeline stays in the ground, according to Dakota Access, forever. Who can challenge that if the pipeline's abandoned? Who pays for it if the pipeline company goes bankrupt? And so that information isn't really there, and they don't know how to weigh those against very short-term economic gains.
And so in the conversations that the board members were having among themselves these past 4 days, which I understand you observed, do you think it was a genuine conversation exploring some of these problems?
I don't think so. I don't think they knew how to evaluate them well. What they need to demonstrate is that Dakota Access has carried its burden of making the case that this pipeline will meet the public convenience and necessity standard set out by law. And so the kinds of things that they were saying, oh, well, this isn't going to weigh in my decision. This will weigh a little more. So Nick Wagner, one of the board members, said, look, the big thing for him is demand. There's a demand for oil, and so Iowans have a demand for oil. They use a lot of oil, so the public obviously needs this. This adds to the diversity of supply mechanisms, so a pipeline or a railway, and that seemed to factor into board member Libby Jacobs' decision. And so those kinds of things, you know, what you see is their predisposition to approve it or not approve it. And I think that what we saw is that two board members are leaning towards it, and I think that there will be some conditions put on it. But has the true public interest been served? And I think not. And I think that the major reason for that is a flawed theory of government, and that theory is that government's main responsibility is to enhance the economy, to grow the economy. And so the argument that Dakota Access is going to add to the economic welfare of Iowa is sufficient. But my theory of government is very different. My theory of government, and I think many Iowans subscribe to this, is that its primary responsibility is to help us take care of each other, doing things we can't do on our own, as public schools, public roads, things like that. And the other main function of government is to take care of the things that we share. In fact, I heard someone define a Midwesterner as taking care of the things that we share. So wildlife, air, water, public schools, the bridges, the roads, all of those things that we share. It's one of the reasons that you get a hunting and fishing license. You're saying, I'm a member of the public and I have a right to access the commonwealth. And so you pay for your hunting and fishing license. But if you're from out of state, you have to pay more because it's not your commons.
And then you're limited at how much you can take.
Exactly. You're limited. What is law? Law is the set of rules we agree to be bound by. And there are two parts to government and to law. So you have the governing entity. So whether it's the legislature, whether it's the governor, whether it's the agencies, falls under the governor. And then the third branch of government is the courts. And what is their job? And I just asserted that it's to help us take care of each other and help to take care of the things that we share. So you have that responsibility. But citizens have a responsibility. Residents of a place have a responsibility. The legitimacy of government is based on the consent of the governed. And when you have limited the ability to withhold its consent or to give its consent, then you undermine the very basis of the legitimacy of government. And so when I said they limited the people wanting to voice their opposition to the pipeline and make it sound like it was even, they were denying the ability of us to withdraw our consent to a project that threatens our communities, the basis of our lives itself, air and water and climate and wildlife, and it threatens future generations. And so the legitimacy of government is at stake. And there are only two things that happen when you challenge the legitimacy of government. Either you get dictatorship or you get anarchy. And so the reason that I've intervened and been trying to get the voice of the public present is because we have a right, a sacred obligation, that kind of right, to withhold our consent to things that damage the very basis of life itself.
Just briefly, were there any other moments in these past 4 days of deliberation that surprised you?
I think I was stunned at how inadequate the law is for making this decision. They're trying to piece together so many different clauses in the statutes and then figure out how this piece of evidence should be factored into that. So they didn't even know how to define public necessity. And I think that when we start to play with that kind of question, then the public is not well served. If you don't even know what the basic words mean that will govern the decision, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. So I'm deeply concerned. I'm sitting in a state that's the most damaged in the union. 97% of Iowa is either plowed up or paved over. And now I think that what we're going to have underground is this entire vast network of pipes moving fossil fuels around in a way that is, I think, going to lead to tragedy. And it's an invisible and slow-moving tragedy. It is a tragedy nonetheless.
Thank you very much, Carolyn Raffensperger.
Thank you.
That was Greta Anderson talking with Carolyn Raffensperger, who was speaking for the Science and Environmental Health Network, which has provided funding for the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition in Iowa. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, and coming up next, my co-host Kay Puttock has an interview about the intersection of government and public interest as it relates to each of us on a very personal way.
Yes, my guest in this next conversation is Terry Lohman, one of the founders of an organization called Iowa Unitarian Universalist Witness Advocacy Network. That's quite a mouthful. We used to pull his leg about that. Or IUUWAN, Iowa. This is a coalition of Unitarian Universalist congregations throughout Iowa who work together to achieve specific goals in areas of social justice. As this clip starts, Terry is talking about some of these general goals, and he goes on to talk about how one of the organization's goals relates very closely to him and his family.
We concentrate on four areas: immigration justice, economic justice, restorative justice, ending mass incarceration. Restorative justice is a term for a different approach to justice. What we have in our country is a punitive justice system. And basically, if you hit me, I'm going to hit you back harder. But nobody heals from that. We're restorative justice. You sit down and talk and you work things out. Sometimes it doesn't work, but most of the time it does. And you end up with forgiveness and understanding and growth, which is what we really want.
Later on in our conversation, Terry and I talked about death with dignity, and Terry gave his personal perspective on this and his insight that he got from the death of his mother, her experience with hospice, and also the insights of Terry's son, who's a physician.
I thought we might start with hospice because that's a movement that was our church has been very involved in, the Unitarian Universalists. And what that started out with was recognizing that death is going to come for everybody, and what can we do to make people comfortable until it does happen? And they got very good at medicating people so that they were comfortable. And with my mom, we were worried, my brother and I discussed that, you know, she was having so much trouble breathing that we should keep her on oxygen. And hospice came in and said, no, if you have her on oxygen, she's going to suffer for 3 or 4 days, where if you pull her off, it'll be a few hours. And my son he's a doctor, and he was doing his residency when Terry Schiavo's big to-do came out. And he said, well, you know, they're framing this wrong. You know, they're talking about prolonging life. What you were doing is prolonging death as opposed to extending life.
Right.
And I think that's, you aren't extending life when a person is in total misery.
Right. And people would argue you're not respecting life either. But they did other things to make her comfortable, I presume.
There are things you can do, but only to a point.
And hospice people are very good at this. They are very good at palliative care, making people feel more comfortable.
Right.
And pain itself, of course, is a terrible stress. And in itself, it does make people sicker.
I heard that almost nobody's afraid of being dead, but we are afraid of getting there.
Yes. Yes. I'm looking up how many states have actually passed death with dignity laws. Oregon, Washington, Vermont, and California. It's not been enacted in California yet, but it has passed. And Oregon, last year, 218 people received prescriptions for lethal medications. And I think it's worth dwelling on that a little bit, because it just reminded me of this when you were talking. People received these medications, and that's all we know. We don't know what they did with them, because I know that people often get these medications and they don't use them. They just feel more comfortable when they've got them. This is to do with being afraid, not being afraid of death, but being afraid of how they get there.
That's exactly right. And as of the end of November 2014, 1,173 people had qualified for getting their prescription, but only 752 had followed through. So about a little over a third of the people never do it. They're comfortable and they're happy knowing that if it gets so miserable, I can go.
Right.
You know, and then they can relax.
Exactly.
I think the long term of it is actually, or the bigger scope is that it probably extends life overall, because there are people who are so afraid of what it's going to be like that they take control of it and kill themselves way too early.
I know people that are chary or wary of death with dignity laws say it doesn't respect human life. It doesn't respect the dignity of human life. And they do bring up some legitimate concerns about people being pressured to take their own life and people that are going to benefit from the will and so on. So I think it's worth talking a little bit about the proposed legislation in Iowa, which I think certainly seems to take care of some of these concerns.
It's pretty much the law that Oregon has passed, and you need to have two physicians separately diagnose you and prescribe the drugs. No physician is required to do it, by the way, and no pharmacist is required to fill the prescription for the barbiturates that they use.
Right.
So no one's going to be compelled to do something they don't want to do.
Yeah, and they must put in two oral requests at least 15 days apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After that, there must be a written request, and then at least 48 hours after that, the prescription mm-hmm. will come. They must be terminally ill. They must be at least 18 years old.
Right.
And mentally, and this is an interesting part. The written request must be witnessed by two people, at least one of whom is not associated in any way with a nursing home, with the attending physician, and is not mm-hmm. a relative or in any way a beneficiary of the person's estate. So, as far as I can see, that really takes care of some of these concerns yeah. that have been raised.
Pope John Paul had all means of extending his life removed. He didn't take death with dignity, but he also had no feeding tubes or anything.
That was Terry Lohman, one of the founders of the Coalition of Unitarian Universalist Congregations in Iowa, the Iowa Unitarian Universalist Witness Advocacy Network, IUN, and as always, we'll put their contact information up on our website. And before we introduce our next guest, let's listen to an audio recording that's especially appropriate for today, President's Day, and also appropriate for Black History Month. This is a brief extract from the beginning of the speech that President Lyndon Johnson made to the Joint Session of Congress in March 1965, as the nation was reeling from the savage beating of civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. To deny a man his hopes because of his color or race or his religion or the place of his birth is not only to do injustice, it is to deny America and to dishonor the dead who gave their lives for American freedom.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, and I'm especially glad to welcome our next guest, Professor Brian Behnken from the History Department at Iowa State. Professor Behnken, have you special experience in the civil rights movement? Or I guess you do, because you did a lot of your work at the LBJ Presidential Library. Is that correct?
I did, yes. When I was working on my first book, which was my doctoral dissertation, I spent a little over a week in Austin at the LBJ Presidential Library. It was a very interesting experience, to say the least. I recommend if you have the chance to go to a presidential library, you do it. They're all somewhat unique, and his library was particularly interesting. It's this very large monolithic structure, very powerful and grand, that would seem to kind of replicate how he saw himself in life. And there's just some interesting features to the library. I remember an animatronic LBJ they had that spun homespun, you know, jokes and wisdom that was actually recordings of LBJ. So it was a very odd, you know, thing to witness this robot mouthing his words, but doing so and moving rather mechanically. It was very strange. It's nothing about civil rights, I know, but.
Well, I just discovered as we were approaching this program that President's Day has been redefined to include all past presidents, I gather, and we thought we'd like to focus on the civil rights aspects of the past presidents. I assumed that Lincoln represented the first of the civil rights presidents. Now, what is your take on that?
Well, it's a good way of looking at Lincoln, I suppose, although not 100% accurate. Lincoln was a very interesting and complicated figure in his own right. He, for many years, held essentially white supremacist views about people of color in the United States. He did believe for many years that white people were superior to black people. Many of his original ideas for what to do about the slaves if they were ever freed was to colonize them to other parts of the globe that he felt like they perhaps would never fit in or never really be a part of the United States. The slavery issue, I think, was not only misconstrued by Southerners who thought that he was the enemy of slavery, but by a lot of other people, kind of in general, who thought that Lincoln was going to end slavery. And in reality, it doesn't seem to be something that was, when he took office at least, wasn't going to be the hot issue for him, I don't think. He had said over many years that he wasn't necessarily opposed to the existence of the institution itself, but merely to its expansion. So he wanted to kind of keep it, in the...
Was that just a politically expedient thing to say, or do you think he really believed that?
That's a good question. What I would say is that his actions in the presidency kind of speak to, at least initially, that being a political, thing to say or political statement. He does very quickly act on, trying to do something about the secessionists and it's it doesn't, I don't think, go the way he or anybody else thought it would. And really, shortly after office, he's more concerned with, how do I reunite the Union? How do I preserve the Union? And I think the slavery issue is secondary at best. He's remembered for the Emancipation Proclamation, but that proclamation doesn't free any slaves. It leaves slavery in place in many parts of the United States. In Texas, where I'm from, slaves didn't know that, there had been emancipation until well after the Civil War was over. So, it's an interesting thing to think about, but I think maybe in some ways Lincoln is perhaps misconstrued as a quote-unquote civil rights president. I will say also towards the end of his life, he did develop this relationship with Frederick Douglass, who's a very well-known black abolitionist. He does seem to have a change of heart when he's thinking about his ideas for Reconstruction. There is a bit more of a, how do we incorporate black people into the American
Frederick
black politics.
Frederick Douglass must have been an incredibly impressive person. It would be hard to.
Well, I think so. And, of course, Frederick Douglass and Lincoln are why we had originally what was known as Negro History Week and now Black mm-hmm. History Month. I could probably say too much about Frederick Douglass and move us away from the topic of presidents and civil rights, but yes, really an amazing individual. One of these type people that I suppose we meet rarely, that it doesn't matter what they do, it doesn't matter kind of what environment they're put in, they're going to succeed at whatever it is they're mm-hmm, going to do, and mm-hmm. he seems to be kind of one of those people.
Well, I think we probably better jump ahead to what we call the civil rights era, unless you want to put in another nominee
I would just say really, really quickly that if we're thinking about kind of Reconstruction era presidents and civil rights, the person to talk about would probably be Ulysses Grant, somebody that, he signed one of the Civil Rights Acts at the time. He signed what was known as the Enforcement Act, which was a successful attempt, I might add, to get rid of the original Ku Klux Klan, and also the 15th Amendment. So,
well, it's interesting because in a lot of American common history, he has a very bad name.
He does indeed. We have to be honest. He ran one of the most corrupt presidential administrations, really probably in American history. We can maybe limit it to 19th century American history, but in general, but yes.
Well, let's move on to the 20th century then.
Sure.
And the civil rights era. And I guess that Kennedy really deserves to be named as the first of the civil rights presidents. And you've done some work on his papers. What is your impression of Kennedy as a civil rights leader?
Yeah, I would say that Kennedy is in some ways a little bit like Lincoln in that his reputation is perhaps a bit misconstrued. He was somebody that You know, I think if I was being generous, I would say that he was fairly lukewarm on the issue of civil rights. He, you know, he didn't, I don't think, have a lot of experience with people of color growing up, so he maybe didn't have the familiarity. He wasn't a Southerner, so he perhaps didn't understand the situation in the South. You know, he had a civil rights bill in the works shortly before he was assassinated, but it was a fairly weak measure. It didn't really have necessarily great teeth to get anything done. There's a famous incident where when King is actually in prison, you know, Kennedy was encouraged to do – this was when he was running for president. He was encouraged to do something about King in prison, and the best that he could come up with was to call King's wife, Coretta Scott King, and basically offer his, you know, support or you know, sympathies or what have you. And mind you, this is accepted and this is appreciated in the black community, but if you think about actions, it doesn't really do a whole lot. Now, I think it would also be fair to say that Kennedy, much like Lincoln, was assassinated before perhaps he could have gotten done things that he might have gotten done. But, you know, once he's gone, it's hard to say what would have happened, mm-hmm. you know, if he had not been killed. And the same with Lincoln.
Well, and then, of course, he was succeeded by Lyndon Johnson.
Yes.
And one of the things in that speech that we heard 44 seconds of, the speech is 49 minutes long, mm-hmm. and quite a very significant speech, I think, deserves to be much better known than it is. Mm. But one of the things that he said to Congress, he's explaining why he's speaking to the joint houses of Congress, but he thinks it's that important. And he mentions that there was a bill that was, he definitely implied that it was prior to his becoming president when the bill was negotiated, and that it did have a voting rights part to it. But mm-hmm. when it came to my desk, that was not there. And this is to correct that. But, of course, the speech was following Selma, so it was at a very dramatic time when people realized all over the country that voting rights were needed, that they hadn't been taken care of mm-hmm. by the Civil Rights Act. And Johnson, of course, really knew how to negotiate with Congress, and he was a Southerner, so he understood all of those aspects and made the very prophetic statement that we will lose the South. Being the Democratic Party, we will lose the South for a generation. I think that's a couple of generations ago. So what do you have to say about Johnson?
You know, Johnson, I think, I find him to be simply a fascinating figure because he could be so intellectual and so gifted in understanding people, and yet simultaneously on many occasions he could be incredibly crass. And
showing his scar there, I remember.
Well, you know, just, you know, just, and he told some really awful jokes. He oftentimes peppered his conversations with the N-word. So, you know, he has this interesting personality, to say the least. But I think I think the thing about Johnson is, and it's an interesting life, and his experiences, I think, are really in Texas are really foundational. He comes to understand, this is one of the things that I and other historians have looked at and focused on and looking at his records. He comes to understand the experience of the African American community, not through black people themselves, but actually through his experience with Mexican origin people in the state of Texas. And we tend to forget about civil rights and Mexican Americans in the United States. But in Texas and for Johnson, this is really for him where he sees what endemic poverty and prejudice and racism and discrimination actually do to people. And I think from there he's able to fairly easily extrapolate for the African American community. The thing about Johnson that I found in looking at his records and in reading what others have written about him is that as president, as a person, he seemed to genuinely care. He seemed to genuinely get as much as a white man in his position at that particular time could, what ethnic minorities and what African Americans in particular were up against. And he wanted to see change. He wanted to see things done. He had worked on some civil rights bills when he was in the Senate. They were the same kind of legislation that Kennedy was looking at that was just very weak-kneed and didn't really do very much and seemed almost like kind of like a pointless nod towards the issue of civil rights. And so when Kennedy is assassinated and LBJ is sworn in, it's almost immediate that he makes it this mission to push through this legislation to do something about the civil rights, or the lack thereof in many parts of the country. And so that's what the Civil Rights Act did. You're absolutely right that the voting part of that doesn't do what he or what a lot of other people would have hoped. And then we see the kind of vicious reaction that happens to black people trying to exercise their constitutional right to vote, and not just in Selma, but in other parts of the South. And he basically says we have to do something about that. If there's anything that fits into that, there are a lot of people that say, like, how is sitting in a restaurant civil rights? And there's a lot of different ways you can argue that. But voting, it seems pretty clear how that is a civil right. And so I think he has this really great, moment where he says, we have to do something more about this. The speech that he gives to Congress, they gave longer speeches back in the day. It's a long speech, but it's got these moments in it. And one of the great moments, of course, is not just him speaking about the dignity of mankind, but he actually incorporates some of the language of the civil rights movement itself when he says, we shall overcome.
Right.
And this was, this was one of these moments in presidential politics where it's, just this thunderclap of attention-getting language, if you will. It's very rare that you see a president perhaps incorporate language like that. And then, of course, he follows through with this very strong voting rights protection that, although it's been somewhat weakened of late, is for many, many years kind of the foundation of voting for underrepresented groups in the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was going to say really quickly, I think LBJ would obviously be much better remembered and would really have his place in that kind of pantheon of great American presidents, but for Vietnam. And Vietnam just really destroys his legacy and he'd be better remembered, but for Vietnam.
Yeah, maybe we should. Could you just briefly talk about Johnson and Vietnam?
Sure, yeah. Well, where to start? I mean, so there's a lot going on. Obviously, this was something that the American involvement with Vietnam had gone, back a decade, or more before. It was something that, going back to Truman and Eisenhower, that the United States had basically said, we're going to initially support the French. Mm-hmm. In South Vietnam, and by the end of the French involvement, the United States was basically footing the bill for the war. So when Kennedy takes over, he begins the process of – it's really a process of escalation, excuse me. I mean, it's something that when LBJ takes over continues. I would say if Johnson is committed to civil rights, he's also committed to fighting the Cold War. So this is – this is a part of it. There are a lot of civil rights historians that look back at Vietnam and feel like, perhaps, especially when civil rights activism moved into the Black Power era, that perhaps Vietnam was a good way to refocus the nation's attention not on these internal struggles but, outside of the country. Of course, that Vietnam created a whole lot of internal struggles in and of itself. I think Johnson wanted to also perhaps be, a president that could claim a real victory against the forces of communism. And even though he had been told otherwise, he believed that Vietnam would be, an easy victory. And it obviously didn't turn out like
that.
Right. Yeah.
Do you see him in some respects as regarding civil rights as a heroic figure? I mean, this statement that Susan quoted, we'll lose the South for a generation. He was basically going against the narrow interests of his own party to do what he believed was right. Do you think that's the right way to think of that?
I think so. I mean, there wasn't anything that Johnson did that wasn't political in a lot of ways. Not that like I said, I think he believed deeply in civil rights and many of these issues, but I think he was always thinking politically, the next step ahead or the next several steps ahead. And this was something that was kind of common, I don't want to say common knowledge, but it was commonly understood that if the Democratic Party picked up the reins of civil rights in the way that he was proposing, that it would probably destroy the Democratic Party in the South. Now, I would say this also, presidential politics and locals and state politics are, in many cases, very different things. And so what we see happening in the South is for many, many years, of course, the Democratic Party hanging on. But, for the president himself and presidential politics very quickly moving to the Republican camp and voting for Nixon in the next election. Yeah, he's making a sacrifice, and I think he knew it at the time, and perhaps, with other states, with Western states, he felt like perhaps it wouldn't matter, that they would be okay.
This is switching gears a bit, but I notice you've written a book about the book about civil rights in Texas. You included the struggle for Mexican Americans.
Yes.
Would you like to talk about that?
Oh, sure. The Mexican-American struggle for civil rights, I would say, is one of the least understood, although we're gaining more knowledge about it. And I mean that in the sense of public knowledge and kind of out there in the public sphere. Scholars have been looking at the Mexican-American experience for many, many years, and it aside from well-known figures like Cesar Chavez, it simply hasn't gotten into the mainstream, perhaps, in the way that it should. I was really drawn to Mexican-American civil rights activism in much the same way that I was drawn to black civil rights activism, because I saw things that I thought were really fascinating. They really complicate, if you will, the picture that we have of what civil rights looks like, because we tend to look at it through this black-white lens or paradigm. And with Mexican-origin people, you see, in some cases, different motivations, different strategies. You know, one of the things that I grappled with early on was there was this perception that historians had, and that I think a lot of people, in the lay public, if you will, had, and that misperception was that all ethnic communities had experienced a similar problem with racism and segregation, and therefore they would obviously unite in their struggle for civil rights. And certainly there are many examples where they do unite, but what I found in Texas for many, many years was actually a resistance to working together. So I titled the book Fighting Their Own Battles, because for many years there were a number of leaders who would, and a number of people on the ground who would just say, their problems are not ours. For Mexican origin people, there's a feeling that if they joined with African Americans, it might actually hamper their struggle, and so a resistance to working together. And I found that to be interesting and wanted to know more about it. Mm-hmm. I could probably go on for the rest of the day about this. But,
you can go on for a few more minutes.
Well, if I could, I'll give you a couple of things that I found in the book that maybe demonstrate what I was saying about complicating our understanding of what civil rights is and how it works. In ways and perhaps in which the Mexican-American civil rights movement really has a foundational impact in the United States in a way that we perhaps don't realize. And so there's this very important Supreme Court case called Pete Hernandez v. Texas. The Hernandez case is handed down by the Supreme Court 2 weeks before the Brown v. Board of Education decision. And I think because of Brown's impact and importance, Hernandez is really not noticed, or is really very quickly forgotten about. But it's important because it's a jury segregation case. Oh. And one of the things that the Mexican-American activists that are involved and the attorneys that are involved, and one of the cases they make is that when we think about segregation, it's not just a black-white issue. And for Mexican-origin people in the South, for people from various Asian countries, or really from any other part of the globe, segregation perhaps looks a little bit different. Mexican Americans in many parts of the country were considered to be white. And so there's this very interesting question that if you have an all-white jury, then how can you say then that there was discrimination if you yourself are white? Can white people discriminate against other white people? And what the Supreme Court concludes is that, yes, indeed, they can. And so here we have this case that it expands the boundaries of the 14th Amendment. It nullifies jury segregation in many parts of the country. It really complicates for the United States and for how the Supreme Court, especially how they look at race And we've kind of forgotten about it. Mm-hmm. The case itself is really interesting too, but I won't go into that in great detail. But that's an example of how we have a case that I would say, you know, it's right in the same time as Brown. It's important, a different type of civil rights, if you will, but important. Again, jury service, one of the things, if you think about what civil rights is, that would tend to fit the, in my mind, it fits the bill. And, you know, it's been forgotten.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and we'd love to have you back to talk about some of these things in more detail.
I'd be happy to.
We're almost out of time. This has been Local Talk, and we're your hosts today, Kay Puttock, along with my co-host, Susan Franzen. On this President's Day, we've been talking with Professor Brian Benken about presidents during the Civil Rights era. Other guests have been Carolyn Raffensperger and Terry Lohman, plus a few friends with lighthearted reminiscence appropriate for the day after Valentine's Day. And on that note, to end with, here's my friend Jenny telling us how her parents met during World War II.
My mother and father met during the Second World War in 1943, when my mother was in the Women's Air Force stationed in Newcastle in England, and my father was also stationed there for a short time. And my father gatecrashed an Air Force dance with his friend, and he was British, and my mother was from Scotland. She was from Paisley, just outside Glasgow, and there was an Air Force dance, and my father was stationed very close to the base, and of course my mother was there, who was an extremely attractive woman, by the way, and she was, and my father was very handsome too,
like their daughter.
Well, apparently, they attended this dance, and Mother noticed him, but wouldn't dare, you know, show any signs of thinking how attractive he was, because, of course, she was in the Air Force and he was in the Army. Okay. So that made a difference. And my father did notice Mum, but there was no contact with them at all at this dance. And about 3 or 4 weeks later, my mother was on a train. And it was one of these trains with just carriages, no corridor. And it pulled in at a station, and they were both going back to Newcastle, you know, to their bases. And he got in a carriage, and who was sitting there but my mother?
Oh, wow.
Our theme is backtracked by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it.
KHOI is now streaming live on khoifm.org, where you can find archives of our shows. Please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.